uniqueness to raise us from brokenness to life. And as we spend time now in your word, may we open our whole self to you. Let us choose to expose the places that fall short to you, because we can trust you with them. It's here we'll find healing, and it's here that we will be given your grace. And so thank you, Lord, for your grace. Thank you for your love. Amen. Thank you for turning on my microphone. I see I failed at that. There's grace. This is a Sunday on grace, so it's a good Sunday to experience it myself. As we begin today, I thought I would just start with something interesting that I learned in preparing for this morning. I like to learn things and find stories, and I learned something about, well, I learned about a panel of German linguists that declare an unword of the year. And I did not know that this existed, and maybe some of you do, but apparently there's this group of German linguists that participate in a panel every year. And they choose one new or recently popularized term that they believe violates human rights or infringes on democratic principles, and they declare it an unword. And I didn't know this, but in 1999, so this has been going on, 1999 seems like not that long ago for someone like me, but for some of you that you weren't born yet then, so I get that. But in 1999, they declared this word, this panel declared the word collateral damage to violate these democratic principles or these human rights. And it was chosen particularly in light of the fact that civilian casualties during the Kosovo War had been called collateral damage. And the jury considered this to be an inhuman euphemism, because referring to civilian casualties as collateral damage somehow dehumanized them. It made them an object instead of a person. And something within us is stirred when that happens. We're not okay with it, because people are people. And collateral damage, it doesn't just feel, we don't just get that sense when we hear it used in terms of people who, like death, when death has occurred. We also have that sense when collateral damage is something that causes unnecessary suffering, when that didn't need to happen. We see this, and an example of that is when someone's trying to get ahead and there are people that are harmed in the wake. Collateral damage happens, and it hurts people around us. People suffer at the expense of other people's desires or their intentions often. And it happens now, and it happened then in Bible times as well. People in the Bible suffered at the expense of others, much like today. And we've been going through this series on Jesus changing everything. And Jesus really did change everything. But he especially changed everything for those people. For the people who went unnoticed, the people who were ignored, the people who just simply were hurt because they got in the way of someone else's agenda. Jesus was fully aware of each person's humanity, and he saw their innate value just because they were human. Like the woman who had been bleeding all her life, who touched his robe and found healing. Not only did his power heal her, but he also saw her. He drew attention to her. She didn't go unnoticed. People like the lame man who couldn't walk. People that in Bible times they would have walked past and ignored were seen by Jesus, because Jesus did not miss seeing people who were often unseen. He paid attention to the dismissed and the ignored, and he saw the people that were hurt in the political crossfire. He saw them with more than his eyes. And today we're going to talk about someone like that, and maybe you're going to be caught by surprise when I tell you where we're going, because today we're going to John 8, and we're going to talk about the woman caught in adultery. Because today I want to explore this story with you with some of these ideas in mind. You see, I've read this story many times, and I've tended to focus on the sin of adultery and of Jesus' response to the woman, but I think I missed some of the pieces. Because this woman had sinned, but in this particular story, she was simply a means to an end. This is the story of a woman whose sin was being put on display with the intent of attacking Jesus. She was not the goal. getting at Jesus was the goal, and we'll see that as we read it. The Pharisees' goal was to take Jesus down, and Jesus responded in this scenario by being consistent with who he was. So open it up with me, because maybe that opening already put a little bit of discomfort in you. Open to John 8. And just, if you have your Bible, have your phone, pop it open. We're going to just stay here a lot today. I'm going to read the whole story. Jesus returned to the Mount of Olives, but early the next morning he went back again to the temple. A crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. As he was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who'd been caught in the act of adultery, and they put her in front of the crowd. "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." And then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. When the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." Jesus saw people. He saw all of the people there. He didn't just see collateral damage. He didn't see the Pharisees. He wasn't even focused on the Pharisees' attack that was really directed at him. He didn't exert his authority as God on earth. Instead, he looked at all of the people there, and he saw their hearts, and he met their needs, and he extended grace. He saw the mask of perfection that the Pharisees wore as they exaggerated and kind of twisted the law for their own sake. He saw their desire to elevate their righteous status or the way they looked so perfect as they drug out someone who had sinned. And he saw the woman. And he knew of her sinfulness. And he saw her need. And I think so often I stopped there and I thought about the Pharisees and scribes and I thought about Jesus and I thought about the woman, but I forgot about the crowd. Because Jesus was also fully aware that the crowd was there. And he met the need of all of them. You see, if you look back in verse 1 to 3, the crowd is right in the beginning of this story. When he went to the temple that morning, a crowd gathered and he was teaching them. He had a whole bunch of people there learning from him that day. They had no idea the lesson they were going to see lived out in what he did, probably more than what he ever could have said that day. And Jesus saw their hearts. I don't know what the heart of the crowd was, for sure. But we can venture some guesses. I would venture a guess that some in the crowd came because they'd heard things about this Jesus and they wondered if they were true. For some, there was probably a curiosity. For some, maybe they really, really needed this Jesus to be who he'd said he was. Maybe they had a glimmer of hope that this could change something for them. For some, maybe there was caution. For some, maybe there was this desire for him to fall like the Pharisees. The crowd probably varied, but they all needed something. They needed Jesus to be consistent with who he had said he was. The crowd needed Jesus to live out in this moment what he'd said and taught and displayed thus far. Then we also have the Pharisees and the scribes there. And I don't know what their hearts were for sure, but verse 6 definitely hints at that. If you look back at verse 4 to 6, verse 6 says this. They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him. The reason they pulled this woman on display was not to uphold the law or to prevent sin from happening. It wasn't even really about the sin that was being put on display right now. This was a trap for Jesus. They wanted to defame him. They wanted to debunk him. And she was just a means to an end. They wanted the crowds that were listening to him that day to see him fail, flounder, falter. They wanted this kingdom that he taught, all this teaching to come to an end. And they were using her for this. And when they posed the question, their hope was one of two things, probably. They wanted him to essentially, to force him to contradict the version of the law of Moses, or to force him to launch a stoning that the Roman government didn't even really allow them to do, as the Jews were not allowed to perform their own executions. They were trying to trap him into essentially losing status or ground in this kingdom he was teaching about and inviting people to. And the Pharisees' intent was to trap Jesus, but this woman got caught in it too. She wasn't innocent, and I'm not for a minute trying to say that she was. But she was simply collateral damage in an attempt to trap Jesus. Adultery is not a sin committed in public. By nature, it's a secret sin behind closed doors. And the law required at least two witnesses to present a case if they were going to bring this accusation forward. And it seems highly unlikely that the Pharisees and scribes, two of them somehow at the same time, landed upon someone committing adultery. More than likely, they were involved somehow in knowing this was going to happen or in setting it up. I don't know for sure. But I am confident they were not innocent in having landed, seeing it so they could drag her before a crowd that day. Adultery is also not a sin committed alone. And yet only the woman is forced here in front of the crowd. Maybe he simply ran faster. We do know that the law does not say that such a woman should be punished. Both parties were accountable. And the inequity of the fact that it's just the woman stirs compassion in us. Because even though she's guilty, it's somehow unjust that she's the only one being dragged forward on display. While she's guilty, she is not alone guilty. And in a society where women are of very little value, they went unnoticed. This seems to be another situation where a woman is being treated as collateral damage, as less than human, as simply a means to an end. Because the sin itself was none of what the Pharisees were concerned about. They wanted Jesus. They wanted him to do something that would turn the people against him. But Jesus wasn't concerned with the pending attack on himself. Jesus was concerned for the people. His mission, his goal was to seek and save the lost. Because everybody needed something from him that day. And without denying her sin, Jesus looked at her and saw her. And he saw the hearts. And he met the needs. I'd already said Luke 19:10 says that Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. He saw the needs of the people there. And although so often I've read this story and only saw the needs of the woman, there's the crowd. There's the Pharisees and scribes. They all had a need. Perhaps everyone in this story was lost, but all for different reasons. They all needed something from Jesus that day. One commentary describes the dilemma of the crowd. Because if Jesus had disobeyed the law of Moses, his credibility would have been instantly undermined. If he upheld the law of Moses, he would have not only been supporting a position that was largely unpopular, but it would have been hard to square away with his well-known compassion for the broken and disreputable, for his quickness to forgive and restore, and with the announcement of the life-transforming power bound up in new birth. Jesus was known for being compassionate and forgiving in nature. And it's probably why the scribes and Pharisees set this up to start. Perhaps the easiest way to turn people away from Jesus would have been to somehow force them to do something that would have made people believe that wasn't really his character. And Jesus saw the Pharisees and scribes their need. He saw the mask of perfection that they wore. He saw the way they used the law to elevate their status. And he knew what they really needed. He knew they needed to stop looking around them and start looking inside them. To start looking out, to stop looking outward and start looking inward. And so you might say that Jesus met their need that day. Not a need that they necessarily recognized they had. Not a need they wanted necessarily to be met, but isn't that a little bit what conviction is? Look at verse 4 to 6. It's when they say, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses said to stone her." They were trying to trap him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. He wrote in the dust with his finger. Now, there's a lot of speculation about what he wrote, and we could go down that rabbit trail for a long time. But there's no way to know for sure, and so I don't want to go there today. I don't want today to be about what could have happened or what he could have written. I want it to be about who Jesus was in this situation. Because when Jesus stooped down and started writing in the ground, the eyes turned from the Pharisees and scribes, and the eyes turned from the woman, and the eyes turned to Jesus. Isn't that where we need to look? He saw the people. He knew their hearts. He met their needs. And he's meeting the needs even now as he acts and says very little. And in bending down to write in the sand, the eyes are now turned to him. It continues verse 7 and 8. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." And then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. Not very many words. But when Jesus said that, when he said that who was without sin should cast the first stone, he's essentially relieving himself of the charge of instigating a stoning. He indirectly ensures that there won't be a stoning, because no one would want to take responsibility for it. And now everyone there is forced to look inward, to reflect on their own sinfulness before God. The phrase "the one without sin" in the original language doesn't just mean sin in the broad sense. It actually means kind of in this specific sin. And I already indicated that probably the Pharisees and scribes, although they were not guilty of adultery, they were probably guilty of being involved somehow in the coordinating of this woman being caught and dragged forward. The Pharisees and scribes are somewhat culpable in the way they set this trap. And in turn, those who came to condemn the woman end up condemning themselves by simply not throwing a stone. And those who came to shame Jesus now leave in shame. It says that when their accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Jesus knew one of the greatest needs of the Pharisees was to look inward instead of outward, and his simple statement caused them to do this. Jesus also met the need of the woman. Her immediate need was safety. She could have been pummeled to death in that moment because of the trap that scribes and Pharisees had set and because of her sin. But the woman's need went so much further than the physical. She had been publicly shamed. She'd been pulled before a crowd of witnesses, and her sin had been put on display for all to see. She had no hope of being anything but an outcast for the remainder of her life, a socially ostracized person with no real hope for the future. And Jesus met this need, not by condoning her sin. He met her need by extending grace. And he didn't extend grace in a private setting. He did it right there. The crowd is still present as Jesus speaks, as Jesus extends her grace. Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." Jesus extended grace. I don't know what the stature, what the woman looked like at that point. Maybe she was crouched in a heap on the ground and didn't even notice they'd left till he asked the question. Maybe she was watching frozen in fear. I don't know. But I know that that day there was one person present who had no sin. I know there was one person present that had the right to cast the stone, and that was Jesus. The person who without question had the right to condemn was the one who chose to give forgiveness, was the one who extended grace. And in doing so, Jesus demonstrated his authority, his ability to forgive sin. John 3:17 said that God sent his son into the world not to judge it, but to save the world through him. And only 5 chapters later, we see Jesus living this out. The woman caught sinning, dragged before the crowd, publicly humiliated, is now the one that Jesus sees. not in the sense of seeing with his eyes, but seeing is in the sense of being known. And Jesus was the only one without sin. He was the one who also chose to extend grace. Grace is unmerited or undeserved favor. And I think the word gets thrown around really lightly these days. There are all kinds of different opinions on life and what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And we'll say, oh, give that person with a different opinion a little bit of grace. But the truth of the matter is, that's not grace, that's kindness. We need to be kind to the people who have different perspectives. Grace happens when I clean off the slate of the person who I have the right to leave a mark for. Grace comes when it's something we cannot, that we don't deserve. It's different than kindness. Grace is seen when the only one without sin, the only one who had the right to shout guilty, is the one who lets her off the hook. Grace covered the woman who had committed adultery, who had sinned and who was wrong. And grace was given her to her by Jesus, as he once again extends forgiveness to the undeserving. Grace was given by Jesus as he provided a way for her restoration rather than her deprivation. But what if the end of this story looks different than you expect? You see, as I was studying, I also realized something about myself. I had painted the end of this story, the picture. I'd written the end in my mind a certain way. I had written the rest of the story to essentially say that this woman then totally committed her life to Christ. She went and never sinned again. She moved on. She lived life in the fullest, and that was her story. But it's not there in the Bible. I don't get to know that. She could have been in bed with somebody else the same day. We don't know. I hope not. But we don't know. And as I wrestled with this, I started thinking, why does that idea bug me so much? And my humanness started to creep in, because I still have this idea that somehow the outcome should have been controlled, that somehow this had only happened to someone who's then going to change. And I realized how warped that maybe is, because that's not grace. Grace is not given because of the outcome. Grace doesn't require or demand. Jesus extended grace not because of who she was or what she was going to do later that day, but because Jesus is gracious. It was because of who he was. Jesus is gracious. Jesus forgives not because we deserve it, but because he is forgiving. Jesus gives grace not to control the outcome, but to invite us to freedom. And even in this story, in this trap that was set, Jesus is consistent with who he is. He doesn't attack and go out after the Pharisees and scribes who set him up. He sees the people, and he meets the needs, and he extends grace. Maybe that bothers you like it did me a little bit, but it made me reflect on who Jesus is. It made me reflect on how I treat others, and it made me reflect on grace. As you think on this story, and as we've had time to kind of process some of the pieces today, I don't know what resonates with you. Perhaps you resonate with the crowd, the ones listening. If you maybe resonate with somebody observing who's looking to see if this is for real, will Jesus always be this person? Maybe this story can fill you with some confidence that Jesus is who he says he is. He sees people and he meets needs and he extends grace consistently. Or perhaps you resonate with the committed followers in the crowd. And if that's the case, may it not just grow your confidence, may it also just inspire you to live this life. May we be predictable people who consistently demonstrate this grace-filled life. Perhaps you see yourself in the Pharisees, and you might cringe. I know I do, but the truth is I've seen it in me. There's a little law keeper in me that at times just, you know, pops up, holds to my own interpretation of things to make myself feel just a little bit better. It's the part of me who thinks I'm a little better than I really actually am. It's the part of me that gets so focused on something that I sometimes forget about the people that might get hurt along the way. It's the part of me that can treat people like collateral damage. And if that's the case, may you allow God to just work in your heart and turn your eyes to Jesus, and for you to look inward instead of outward. Perhaps you can relate to the woman. Maybe you feel like your sin has been put on display and you're not safe. Maybe you feel ashamed or exposed. Or maybe you feel like you are the collateral damage at the expense of someone else's agenda. Know that Jesus sees you. He's not unaware of what's fully going on around you. And may you find hope in Jesus' response, because Jesus' life revolved around his mission to seek and save the lost. And there is no such thing as collateral damage in Jesus' world. He's concerned for you, and he loves you, and he invites you to be his child, no matter what you've done and no matter where you've been. And for today, may we all seek to be a little more like Jesus. May we see people. May we choose to meet the needs that are around us, and may we extend grace. That grace that doesn't expect an outcome. That grace that doesn't demand that we get to write the end of the story. May we be unwilling to see people as collateral damage. Because we all need something from Jesus. And those around us do too. Let's pray. Jesus, we all need you. You are the one who extends the grace that we need. You're the one who truly meets our needs. You're the one who sees us. You're the one who sees us when we feel forgotten. You're the one who knows our pain when we're hurting. And you're the one who, with only a few words and actions, can meet the need of so many. We thank you for your gift of grace. We thank you for your example of how to live a grace-filled life on earth. And may we not only receive what you give for us, but may we be a light in this world. A representative of you to a world who needs to be seen, who has needs that need met, and a world who needs us to extend this grace that you've given to us. In your name.